Good evening, everybody. We are live from the secret orbital moon base, bringing you Starman and the Zoomer, a label we don't really use, but the playlist is called.
Hello.
I'm joined by my, I suppose, usual co-host, because we do have the occasional ones without you. I'm my usual co-host, Evelyn.
Weather report, I am mildly crippled by a severe bout of tendonitis.
Possibly.
Otherwise, things are okay.
Yes. Evelyn has very long legs, and because she has very long legs, they don't work.
My knees no worker so good.
Her knee no worker so good.
yes, but if you are somehow watching this stream for the first time, or you're a regular viewer and you are not aware, there are some ways you can choose to support the streams we do here. You can give money directly to us via the Ko-fi, which is the link I believe Trump's just at right now.
Yes, there will be links. And
you
it
can
will be in the chat.
Give money via the super chats, or you can become a member of the channel on YouTube. Even further than that, I suppose you could subscribe to the Substack if you so choose to, and also consider buying a copy of Book for all your loved ones' Christmases.
Yes. I'm trying to get some stuff on. Never remember how to
WYFL. It's there. It's literally the second autocomplete right there.
There it is. No, no.
For someone who's such a script kiddie, you've got some writing ineptitude when it comes to your autocomplete.
You can, of course, always.
If you want to know more about what I'm getting at here, buy books. Other than that, don't ask me what.
Buy a book.
Yes.
it's still for sale, and like we said, the Ko-fi 2 is a good way to support.
I don't know.
Us.
I mean, like,
otherwise, you can just do it through YouTube because we are still fully monetized somehow.
I was gonna say it's probably too late now, but I don't know. Do we try and get some sort of quick code knocked up for the book for over the Christmas week next week or something?
We'll do it in January. Fuck
yeah,
it.
January sales.
Yeah, we'll give you a January sale.
So
how
you can
that?
All pay full price at Christmas and then buy another copy a month after.
It's just we've been busy and haven't really been able to sort a code for that. But today we are talking in more detail about David Betts.
Yes.
Specifically, we skimmed over it last week, but we have a lot to cover. And we'll get right in, really, to doing the virtual dimensions of contemporary insurgency and counterinsurgency, not quite in full, but this really is his rawest version of it.
Yes.
It is early enough in his career that he is coming out and saying certain things that would become, because of developments of things like the 77th Brigade, unpalatable to say publicly these days.
I mean, yes, I think that's part of it. I think more so, in a sense that we looked at the kits and stuff,
yes,
this is taking the raw dynamic elements of that, the asymmetric warfare and whatever else, and applying it to the environment of the internet.
Yes.
And the subject matter in this case being global jihad, that after having war with sort of Muslim nations of a certain sort, the war had to grow further and into wider fields, and ergo the problem became not just Islamic countries, but Islam everywhere.
Yes.
And as such, a framework had to be sort of drafted and maintained to keep conflict on that regard working effectively for the GAE, NATO, whatever you want to call it, the US Empire.
Yes.
And what our contention really is, as we slightly mentioned on the stream last week, that when we read this and we say phrases like global jihad or Muslims, think about what they call the far right, or possibly even yourself. And again, our contention here right at the start is not that there is a civil war or that people like us represent an insurgency. We do not. But through a lot of this document, I think we'll go to show the techniques and the ways in which we are managed as if we are one.
Well, the context here and the sly trick of Betts' own version of value-free analysis is that you forget the time, the place, the subject matter, and the machinery around it. I will add something we don't usually do, which is a moral container to some of this. If you look at what David Betts is doing here and when he is doing it, the entire thesis, the entire thrust of this document is repulsive. It is, quite frankly, immoral and disgusting what is being done here. Because in 2008, David Betts is writing The Dimension of Contemporary Insurgency and Counterinsurgency about the now ingrained counterinsurgency that the US allies, in quotes, are fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq and spreading to other corners of the world. There's already talk about Yemen. This is pre the Arab Spring, which is really this framework writ large. If yes. you look at what happens with the Arab Spring. But here we are in 2008. The war in Afghanistan is protracted, it is long, and nobody quite knows what it is for. The memories of 9/11 are beginning to fade in people's minds. As I talk about in Freedom Fries and Coronation Chicken, one of the essays in the book, by 2008 as well, the narrative of jingoism for the Bush era has turned to the Obama-based shame, or is turning into the Obama-based shame, despite him going on to become the drone striker in chief. This is a political moment at which self-reflection is going on within America and Europe about what they are doing in the Middle East and its complete pointlessness. And enter David Betts. These people have been occupied for nebulous policy reasons, and now the intelligence services, the Five Eyes, well, the 6 points, if you want to go that way, with Mossad's involvement, are waging a counterinsurgency upon them. This is not a counterinsurgency against narratives being brought into the West. We'll read the opening paragraph first, because there's a bit more I want to add to this. But as we go along, I will periodically remind you that this is in service of invading countries and then processing their population via propaganda.
I think the only thing I will add before we get right into this, and I'm saying this as much for us as I am for the audience here, this will be quite dense, and we're going to try and read as much of this as we think we can fit in, along with some other bits.
Yes.
So feel free to come back to this at some point. The stream will still be here, because we don't want to try and explain every word, but it's too good not to miss. Anyway, the contemporary operations environment which theatre commanders in the global war on terror must be concerned has two dimensions. The first is the actual tactical field of battle in which bullets fly, bombs explode, and blood is shed. The second is the virtual, informational realm in which belligerents contend with words and images to manufacture strategic narratives more compelling than those of the other side, and better at structuring the responses of others to the development of events. The latter is, this author argues, essentially the dimension in which what is increasingly viewed as the war of ideas with global jihad is conducted. Many fear we are losing in this dimension. In February 2006, in a speech to the Council on Foreign Relations, then US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged as much.
I love that there's Council of Foreign Relations and Rumsfeld there. Just in the wild.
Our enemies have skillfully adapted to fighting wars in today's media age. But for the most part, we, our country, our government, has not adapted. Consider that the violent extremists have established media relations committees. These are terrorists, and they have media relations committees that meet and talk about strategy, not with bullets, but with words. They've proven to be highly successful at manipulating the opinions of elites of the world. They plan and design their headline-grabbing attacks using every means of communication to intimidate and break the collective will of free people. Now, of course,
this comes across now as ridiculous.
Well, this is also a man speaking from a position where he's well aware of what America did in Afghanistan in the 70s and 80s and why these people have media relations committees, because you built them for them.
Well, it's also, unless you actually buy into the global war on terror narrative circa 2005, I don't think we have to sell that to people.
No.
Like, this is, again, if you look at the container here, it's very obvious that what's happening is they're talking about a media war with people they have invaded.
Mm.
The narratives that take hold in these populations they're trying to conduct a counterinsurgency against is a narrative of we shouldn't have been invaded and destroyed.
Mm.
We shouldn't have been invaded for nebulous policy reasons. And as we go through this, I want you to keep in your mind that David Betts is turning round to these people and going, you deserve unlimited informational war for the crime of being invaded by us. Anyway, we shall continue.
Islamists are succeeding in the virtual dimension because the organisation and method of their operations is better adapted to the information age than our own. Our forces are unmatched in the ability to manoeuvre metal machines to deadly effect in physical battle. The other side is proving to be better at the purposeful shaping of people's thoughts and beliefs. More specifically, this paper argues there are one overarching and three specific reasons that the West is faltering.
Another point I want to add here is that notice how this in the paragraph before frames this as a counterpunch. This is the essential thing that liberal democracies, in quotes, do. They have created a situation in which they've invaded these nations, and now because they are losing, quote unquote, the battle of hearts and minds in places they've invaded, they are now creating a counter framework as if they were being attacked themselves. The frame of this is that they are losing an informational war to a global jihadi network. And if they lose that war, global jihad will win.
First, we have not adapted our warfighting structures, which includes the whole of government, not just the armed forces, to the new information-dominated operational environment. As a result, we fight the war of ideas in an ad hoc manner, as though the information second campaign were secondary or tertiary in importance, whereas the other side treats it with resolute consistency as the main event to which everything else is subordinated. Now, I find that more interesting than anything else.
Yes.
That is an admittance that the worldview, which should dominate every aspect of NATO's imperialism in the Middle East, doesn't.
No.
It's done for practical reasons pragmatism and slight flavours of humanism, whereas jihad and Islamism as a total worldview dominates these people's lives every minute and every second. And
yes.
It's about either making their narrative so scattered and abstract that it no longer provides that anymore, or attempting to make the NATO sort of narrative so intense that it can dominate that in the minds of other people.
Well, there's also the aspect here that they're fighting as well nationalist forces. A lot of what they're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan is simply communities who want to expel them.
But they have an entire encompassing view of the world and the American...
Well, to them, it is an existential war for their own existence.
Yes.
But to the Americans, and especially as we learn here, the domestic audience...
It's another skirmish.
Yes.
In short... We are not winning the virtual battle because we have not really put much into fighting it. For instance, there is no single office for the leadership and implementation of information policy. There was one during the Cold War in the form of the United States Information Agency, but it was broken up and rolled into the State Department in 1999.
Isn't that the State Department is responsible for propagandizing the American people, technically.
Huh. Second, we focus too much on trying to shift the outcome of what is essentially an intra-Muslim debate about the correct interpretation and implementation of jihad. This is a vital and consequential debate, but is not one which we as outsiders can contribute to in a sophisticated and convincing way.
Well,
so you're going to have to subvert them, possibly.
Third... By contrast, we do not focus enough effort on winning the hearts and winning and maintaining the hearts and minds of the most critical and accessible population, our own. Clearly, armed forces do not want to be concerned with the management of domestic perceptions of conflict. Here comes the caveats. Nor should that be their responsibility, although soldiers of all ranks must be ever aware of the impact on the virtual battlefield of everything they do in the real one. Instead, in the United States, there is a specific legal impediment to doing so in the form of the 1948 Smith-Mund Act, establishing USIA, which required that propaganda intended for foreign audiences shall not be disseminated within the United States, its territories, or possessions. Here is T.X. Haynes argues that the war we now face is one in which our opponent uses all available networks, political, economic, social, and military, to convince the enemy's political decision-makers that their strategic goals are neither achievable or too costly for the perceived benefit. It is rooted in the fundamental precept that superior political will, when properly employed, can defeat greater economic and military power. There's another trick here, which I talked about last time, which is the fact that it never moves outside the frame, and it goes, well... What if the global war on terror is a massive waste of time and resources for the West?
No, you can't ask that question.
What if we have led ourselves into a blind alley which our populations can see and are disgusted by their complete rejection, continuous rejection? It's one of the few things that Western populations can agree on, that they do not want to persecute the forever wars, and yet they persist. And if that is the case, then we are ignoring the defense of a critical vulnerability. What he's arguing for here is effectively informational total war.
Well, I think as you got me to put down in the notes here, somewhere on page 28, there is a bit for that footnote 4.
Which is, this is quite amazing. Here's footnote 4.
The provisions of the Smith-Mund Act, Title 22, Chapter 18, Subchapter 5, Section 1461 on the dissemination of information abroad can be viewed on the US Code Collection. Yeah. See also Murphy and White. Propaganda can a word decide a war. Forgotten is that the intent of the Smith-Mund was to repair what was seen as a dysfunctional propaganda system by creating the now defunct US Information Agency. Not to forbid propagandizing. Concern not to transgress the bounds set out in Smith-Mund are clear in the recent declassified Information Operations Roadmap, states future operations require that PSOB capabilities be improved to enable PSYOP forces to rapidly generate and disseminate audience-specific commercial-quality products into denied areas.
What into denied areas means into, like, the US population, into, as in denied areas by the Smith-Mund Act.
Or agitation as well.
Yes.
And that these products focus on aggressive behavior modification of adversaries at the operational and tactical level of war. The likelihood that PSYOP messages will be replayed to a much broader audience, including the American public, requires that specific boundaries be established for PSYOP.
That, again, what he's actually saying there is that, well, technically, as we all know, the Smith-Mund Act doesn't actually prevent propagandizing. It doesn't actually do that. What it does is it has a fig leaf there. Sorry, here's the playbook.
The Smith-Mund Act, it's just a bit up there.
Yeah. And if that's... did we get to this bit here, sorry?
Yes. The United States, in particular, it is argued, possesses a quagmire mentality which gifts its enemies with a playbook for...
Again, it's this. The problem is that the wars that have resulted in quote unquote quagmire mentality were adventurous policy wars. They were never wars of direct dominion or existential conflict. Fourth and most important, we struggle to be persuasive in the versional dimension because the messaging that we wish to convey lack narrative coherence. Basically, what we say does not always align with what we do. Others have noted the enormous harm our cause is done by the evidence gap between our rhetoric, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they talk about the Sidney Blumenthal, successful strategic communications, assumes a defensible policy, a respectable identity, a core value. In commercial marketing, the product for sale must be well-made and desirable. The strategic communication stratagem hasn't been built that can pull a poor policy decision out of trouble. It's beyond the scope of this paper to say how to square the circle of the desire to spread democracy with the perceived need to maintain relations with friendly tyrants. Again, here's David Betts talking about spreading democracy. He's actually using the term spreading democracy in terms of the forever wars positively.
However, I think he's demonstrating the fact that he's not an idiot here.
Yes.
Because what he's tipping his hand at is the fact that narratively these two things don't go together.
Yes.
So why not change the environment so that they do?
What the paper will do, however, is outline a practical model of narrative coherence, which illustrates where we have gone wrong thus far and how we may conduct information campaigns more skillfully and with less chance of backfire in future. How do we better create the forever wars? Again, how was this person allowed in? Why did nobody read his output? Why are we the ones bringing up the fact that he is an amoral cheerleader for endless death? And and not only that, but he's arguing that an information war should be persecuted in an unlimited manner, not only against foreign populations, but against domestic populations.
So we can head on to page 7.
Part 1, Propaganda 2.0, explores the disaggregate key concepts, including the virtual dimension, the war of ideas, strategic narratives, Web 2.0, and propaganda, particularly in the form of propaganda of the deed. Vertical narrative coherence, truthiness, looks at the way in which the power to persuade in the virtual dimension rests largely on the ability to link narratives across a vertical spectrum from the cultural, eschatological at the top to the local and individual at the bottom. Hegemony means hegemony. Part three, the theatre of operations, looks at the three main ways in which the virtual dimensions of today differ from the virtual dimensions of the past. Fight the war of ideas like a real war, discusses how we might fight in the virtual dimension better than we have so far. The paper concludes with a reflection on the conduct of contemporary warfare now that Marshall McLuhan's global village, often used as a metaphor for the internet, would seem uncontroversially to have arrived. So, shall we skip to...
Right.
Yes.
Just put it first on this main bit here.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple of bits out here, and then I think we want to get to page 8 to 10 after this. So where it says first, fill up a bit.
Yes.
First, because conflict in the virtual dimension is a thing which is largely psychological, it is used in the sense in which literary critics employ it as a meaning existing in the mind or as a product of the imagination. Second, because global communications, in particular the internet, are so integral to the virtual dimension, it overlaps with, but is not exclusive to, the sense in which computer sciences employ it, meaning carried on by a means of a computer or computer network.
It's just been a bit, yeah. The term war of ideas also needs discussing because the term is more frequently used, but is also inadequately defined. A key point to note is that if something is a misnomer, another is that it is used to refer interchangeably to two separate wars, which need to be disaggregated. It's something of a misnomer because confrontation of ideas is more... again, he's doing a bit of redefinition here. The distinction can be found... where are we headed? What we face instead is a state of continuing hostility conducted largely by non-military means, most importantly, political propaganda and political agitation. The next bit, sorry, we'll get through this pretty fast here, but the next bit I want to refer to... That is the bit on page 8 I wanted to highlight.
Page 7 you're looking
at. Yes.
Bottom of page 8.
It is the midpoint. Here we go. Another concept which bears dwelling on is the idea of strategic narrative. On this subject, there are two gurus, King College London's Professor of War Studies Sir Lawrence Freedman and John Hopkins University Professor Michael Vallos. It is worth quoting Vallos at length.
In war, narrative is much more than just a story. Narrative may sound like a fancy literary word, but is actually the foundation of all strategy, upon which all else, policy, rhetoric, and action is built. War narratives need to be identified and critically examined on their own terms, so they can illuminate the inner nature of the war itself.
I will say we did go over this particular section last week, but we're going to go over it again because it is so vital.
Because we want to look at the bottom of page 10 anyway.
Yeah.
War narratives does three essential things. First, it is the organising framework for policy. Policy cannot exist without an interlocking foundation of truths that people easily accept because they appear to be self-evident and undeniable. Second, this story works as a framework precisely because it represents just such an existential vision. The truths that it asserts are culturally impossible to disassemble or even criticise. Third, having presented a war logic that is beyond dispute, the narrative then serves practically as the anointed rhetorical handbook for how the war is to be argued and described. Think about when anyone says anything to you positive about immigrants and tend to follow with the phrase, well, we've always been a nation of immigrants.
Yes.
This is, in a way, this sort of truthiness or this sort of self-evident truth that is hard to dissemble that they provide. Maybe it's one in regards to some other motive of politics that we must support the only democracy in the Middle East or whatever else. Friedman, more concisely, refers to strategic narratives as compelling storylines, which can explain events convincingly and form which inferences can be drawn. Both emphasise two things, however, which are vital for this discussion, because they illustrate the challenge we face as counterinsurgents on the virtual battlefield, and because they go a long way to explaining why our preponderance of power in the physical dimension belies a more profound anemia in the virtual one.
1. Strategic narratives do not arise spontaneously, but they are deliberately constructed or reinforced out of the ideas and thoughts that are already current. Do not be the thin end of someone else's wedge. They express a sense of identity and belonging and to communicate a sense of cause, purpose, and mission. Strategic narratives are not analytical, and when not grounded in evidence or experience, may rely on appeals to emotion or on suspect metaphors and dubious historical analogies.
Again, although he wrote long before the days of the internet, it's helpful to look to McLuhan to understand why the above matters. We tend to think of information in warfare as inherently and obviously good. When you think about the power of weapons, it clearly is. The better your information, the less military hardware you need to accomplish the destruction of this or that target. But not all the war-fighting advantages of the information age need necessarily to accrue the more technologically sophisticated and rich. Indeed, McLuhan says, in the new electronic age of information, the backward countries enjoy some specific advantages over the highly literate and industrialized cultures. For backward countries have the habit and understanding of oral propaganda and persuasion, small groups a la Alul,
yes,
that was eroded in industrial societies long ago.
They are not atomized.
No, they have not been abstracted.
They have not been through a project of de-civilization,
yes,
in a very real sense.
McLuhan describes Western society as being poised between two processes, detribalization and retribalization. The city itself is traditionally a military weapon and is a collective shield of plate armour, an extension of the castle of our very skins. Before the huddle of the city, there was the food-gathering phase of man the hunter, even as men have now in the electric age returned physically and socially to the nomad state. Now, however, it is called information gathering and data processing, but it is global and ignores and replaces the form of the city, which has, therefore, tended to become obsolete. Electric technology, the globe itself can never again be more than a village. Today, we appear to be poised between two ages, one of detribalization and one of retribalization.
This is perhaps why the West struggles more to develop compelling strategic narratives. Our sense of identity, belonging, and cause is incoherent because we are poised between two states which make us vulnerable for the same reason, the most vulnerable state for any army is on the march, is halfway through a river crossing. In contrast, in the book Globalized Islam, Oliver Roy introduces the concept of virtual ummah, in which he says, the perfect place for Muslim individuals to express themselves while claiming to belong to a community, to those enactment they contribute, rather than being passive members of it. No lack of identity or sense of cause there. What he's politely trying to say is that we are being turned into interchangeable human units
and
who believe in nothing.
And what sense of identity, yeah, and inherent character that people in the Muslim world have, they have an ability to express this online in a manner that becomes exponential. It amplifies this effect to the point whereby they feel a more stronger sense of themselves than they otherwise would have. It's the inverse effect from what we have had on the internet, and it might even pose possibly questions as to why certain people are using certain bits of the internet to re-tribalize us in this sense.
Thinking of Friedman's second point, we can see that there are other disadvantages we face when it comes to creating compelling strategic narratives. In the West, narratives which are deliberately constructed by governments are almost immediately rejected for the reason, whatever the inherent accuracy or falsity. The public is highly sensitized to spin the media exerts at revealing and counterspinning it, and no narrative can long survive the perception that it is based, even in part, on a lie. Narratives which reinforce already existing ideas, on the other hand, are easily portrayed as populist demagoguery. Arguments which appeal to the reason are deemed more trustworthy than those which appeal to emotion and historical analogy, but in the same time, generally people lack the patience for a long argument. Basically, if you need to target your base and find that it is fractured and lacks purpose, lacks the attention span or in-depth appeal to argument, but is exquisitely sensitive to manipulation and possesses an innate mastery of semantics, semiotics, then you have a problem. And if, moreover, your opponent's base is unified, has a sense of purpose, a ritual tradition which lends itself well to story listening and telling, and is fairly credulous when it comes to conspiracy theories, then you have got a very serious problem. What he's describing here is natural communities versus an inhuman managerial machine. And but I will say, to think about this in context as well, They lost. David Betts and his informational warriors were powerless against the goat herders of Afghanistan because they refused to be therapeutized. They simply waited until the West left. They were right. Their strategy prevailed and they won.
Mm.
Really. And that is the lesser, the other context of this, that they did all of these awful things. They told all of these lies and they created all of this propaganda for nothing. They failed. Because you can't convince a goat herder that he should be blown up.
Yes.
You can't convince someone that they should be destroyed civilizationally. You actually can't do that. Thank you, internet talkers. Yes.
Digbic 1034 with his tenor. I think we want page 13. I'll crack on for a bit if you want.
Let us go down to page 13.
I mean, I would say for the bits that we haven't read of this year, homework over the Christmas and New Year's period is to go and read the rest of this for yourselves because it is just indispensable. Right, part two, vertical narrative coherence, truthiness.
Yes.
Let us return, therefore, to the concept of narrative, a concept for which both the scholarly defence and security community and practising soldiers have developed a consuming interest of late, as evidenced by the recent proliferation of doctrine and guidance on influence operations. God, they didn't write this for it to be spoken out, did they?
Much of the discussion of narratives in this context of contemporary warfare, as noted above, centres on the concept of strategic narratives. What is not well understood, however, are two things. First, that narratives operate at several levels, of which the strategic level is just one, and intermediate at that. And second, that the quality of credibility or persuasiveness in the war of ideas inheres from being able to logically connect these narratives vertically. He's talking about information hegemony. That's why he said about the whole government.
In an oft-cited paper in the American Sociological Review, Anne Swidler argued that there is a continuum from ideology, through tradition, common sense, via which can be explained how culture shapes action. Ideology, says Swidler, is a highly articulated self-conscious belief and ritual system, aspiring to offer a unified answer to problems of social action. Traditions are articulated cultural beliefs and practices, but ones taken for granted, so that they seem inevitable parts of life, diverse rather than unified, partial rather than all-embracing. They do not always inspire enthusiastic assent, but are considered natural nonetheless. Common sense is the set of assumptions so unself-conscious as to seem a natural, transparent, undeniable part of the structure of the world. This three-part schema is a useful way of conceiving of the levels of narrative in the ongoing war of ideas. Specifically, with a modification of titles, we may use it to locate the areas in which Islamist narratives are proving more persuasive than our own.
We'll leave that.
I would stick this little bit on here as well because it's quite good.
Yeah.
At the top level, akin to Swidler's ideology, there is a cultural, eschatological narrative which has to do with idealized visions of the future of humanity. At the bottom is a vast multitude of local or individual narratives in which people form ideas about what they should or should not do and what rewards or penalties they will incur from a particular course of action. The narrative is not for the individual. It's for the group, and it pertains to the group's fate overall.
Yes.
That, I think, really, and the rest of what's recognised in this section, which is worth a read in of itself, it can be summarised very simply in the same way that Bowden did. There are two things liberal democracy cannot integrate into itself: radical Islam and the far right.
Yes.
Because they have narratives and stories that pertain to this sort of eschatological, overarching sort of compass of everything there, really. And, of course, by extension of that, we would also be discussing how one might interpret and reinterpret the narrative, say, put forward by the far right online, so that you can steer their narratives towards this sort of eschatological supreme, but whilst also maintaining your own.
Well, this is very funny in that it seems to... this is very much him talking about how America skirts its own propaganda laws. This is about Milblog, about the fact that during the war on terror, the US government tried to get a whole bunch of soldiers to blog. They did so initially with minimal restriction, and it was a disaster. It was a bit of an embarrassment to them. So they brought in regulation.
Do you mind quickly posting a link to this in the chat? There's just a few people asking. I think they want to get it up and basically read along here. So,
sure. I thought we'd already posted this.
It's posted now.
It is posted now. It is in the chat. It should be in the description on the VOD for this too. The regulation enjoined all army personnel to consult with their immediate supervisor and their OPSEC officer for an OPSEC review prior to publishing or posting information in the public forum. And an army web risk assessment cell was established with responsibility for reviewing the content of the army's publicly accessible websites as well. Conduct routine checks of websites on the World Wide Web for discourse of critical and or sensitive information that is deemed potential OPSEC compromise. The new regulation was greeted initially with anger by those in the mill blogging community. This is the final nail in the coffin for combat blogging, said retired paratrooper Matthew Burden, editor of the Blog of War anthology. No more military bloggers writing about their experiences in combat zone. This is the best PR the military has. It's the most honest voice out of the war zone and it's being silenced. However, the regulation does not seem to have significantly diminished the enthusiasm for mill blogging. As of 2007, the website millblogger.com was aggregating some 1,794 mill blogs. Moreover, the US Army shortly after issued the regulation released a fact sheet entitled Army Operation Security Soldier Blogging Unchanged, clarifying its position, essentially that soldiers should blog on military issues responsibly and take care of OPSEC considerations. And a prize-winning paper by the Army Public Affairs Officer appeared in the Military Review arguing that qualified support of mill blogs is good policy. Qualified support, yes. While there are threats to mill blogs, they should be not overstated. Most soldiers understand they need for operational security, and the opportunities far outweigh them. More importantly, the Army can reinforce its communications with the mainstream media by declaring its independence from it using the tools of the modern informational domain.
Not actually having independence, but just saying it does.
Well, it's also just the fact that even the American media didn't have the stomach for what these people were doing.
Well, the next line here is brilliant. Without question, the domestic and international media are not a neutral force on the battlefield, and winning modern wars requires both battlefield success and mobilization of domestic and international public opinion. By communicating directly with the American public, using the internet to provide accurate, timely information that was previously available only from the media, if and when they chose to report it, the Army now positively influences public discussion. In other words, there are tentative signs that counterinsurgents are beginning to grasp the nature of the virtual dimension and how to operate in it. But the insurgents are still way ahead of this particular learning curve. In short...
By the way, Millblog was an embarrassing... It became... More stuff came out of it after that, which showed just the extent to which it was intelligence officers writing propaganda. It was fully discredited and basically shut down because it became such a contentious point as the Obama years started.
But again, this is the same point, and it's the same thing that applies to us. It's not about banning you on Twitter. It's about changing the environment so that what you says on Twitter doesn't benefit your want to create a counterinsurgency.
Well, here's...
Or insurgency, I should say.
Here's a paragraph that basically owns all the posters.
Mm.
Amateurs can surpass professionals.
It follows from above that opinion formers are no longer as closely tied to traditional media as they are. Indeed, in the virtual dimension, anyone with a digital camera, a laptop and an internet connection can play. While single-issue, unaffiliated amateur reporters are unlikely to rival traditional outlets and readership overall...
Boy, did that not pan out.
...on their particular subjects only a few years after it became possible for such a form of reporting, a handful of them gained a voice comparable to traditional media at a fraction of the cost. Moreover, arguably, the relationship of the reader with such non-traditional journalists is more intimate and trusting than is the case with traditional media.
Do you see?
This is strongly suggested, at least anecdotally, by the comment on Michael Yon's highly popular Dispatches series. The following are typical. Ivo Vitger says, I hate to sound gushing, but I keep meaning to thank you for reminding me and the world what old school reporting is really about.
Yeah, these are just like comments about... Yeah, sorry, go on, yeah.
You not only put the US media to shame, but your work gives those of us outside the US a rare and much-needed glimpse of the real war in Iraq. John Letart says, Mike, great reporting. I've followed you from the start and truly appreciate your work. I am immensely glad for the moral effect I know you have on our troops. You seem to be the voice crying out in the darkness, and it seems to be dawn. In short, don't ban communications. Don't create a monolith. Create a narrative where you have independent reporters, independent institutions who are really acting in opposition to the big guys.
Yeah, but really they're...
telling you the same fucking story.
Yeah, he's talking... Yeah, although traditional media still predominates, some amateur reporters finding original stories to their own blogs are attracting online audiences, which are a significant fraction of what professionals in some of the largest traditional media outlets are managing. This is another one. Readers play a role in deciding what is news. I think it's this bit here. The social media system is increasingly recognized as being vulnerable to manipulation by those seeking to move
particular ideas for commercial purposes.
Yes.
For instance, a fake story on Dig on the recall of several hundred thousand Sony PlayStation 3s affected Sony's stock.
So here's this.
What is less well recognized is how it is used by those seeking to move particular ideas for political purposes. The phenomenon is not exclusive to Dig by any means. Popular websites from YouTube through BBC News and most major newspapers offer mechanisms by which readers can comment on articles or videos and influence how prominently ideas are represented. This is not to say that such comments necessarily affect the decision of the editors of these papers. Rather, they influence the perception of the readers of those articles and comments in ways in which the editor may not have intended or considered.
Well, you read between the lines here. You can really see the seeds of what he decides to basically become this.
Yes. Why wouldn't you bot the comments on BBC News articles with hundreds of posts? Which are in opposition to the BBC, so they look like an organic independent point.
Yeah.
Are really arguing from a great...
The comments are even more pro-Ukraine than the BBC.
Yeah. Narrative, yes.
The BBC news comments are even more pro-Ukraine than the BBC.
Fundamentally, the news cycle is no longer a closed one with government and media spinning each other while the public looks on passively. The public is now an active player. And because of the architecture of social media, small groups, are able to direct the news in ways that serve their political ends through the manipulation of discussion forums and comment pages, as well as the generation of counter-analysis.
He's talking about us.
The global insurgents have recognised this fact. For instance, in June 2007, the Global Islamic Media Front announced a media campaign, the declared purpose of which was to counter the messages against the Islamic State in Iraq, put out by Arab and Western media agencies, and to stop the increasing military campaign against the ISI by Sunni organisations in Iraq. In a message titled, The Bartar Media Raid, How to Participate, How to Help, What is My Role? Campaign's goals and methods including infiltrating non-Islamic forums for the purpose of posting pro-ISI propaganda were described. What we expect from you, brothers and sisters...
We can do with moving... We got a lot to go here.
We're quite near the end, actually.
Okay.
What we expect from you, brothers and sisters, is for the Islamist forum to be like beehives during the raid, whereby one person takes part in distributing material, another generates links, one person writes an article, while another writes a poem. People must feel and notice that the forums have changed radically during this blessed raid. Beloved raid participants, the raid is dependent on you. The raid demands of you many things, such as expertise, especially in the following areas. I mean, I suppose we can clip this shot here and basically say whether this was Islamists noticing this on their own behalf or really probably working on the behalf of the CIA or some other group.
I'd rather read this bit.
No, go for it. I was just going to say it's all consensus cracking.
It is indeed.
It's a prototype of that.
Well, it's, again, it's this idea, though, that there is this... Have any of you... especially in this era, did any of you on the internet between 2005 and now actually encounter Islamist propaganda that you could understand and read? I spent a lot of, apart from the IS videos, which a lot of which were created by American the good rebels in quotes. But apart from when we got to the IS era, there really wasn't a Muslim information war in the West. Mm-hmm. To say so would be ridiculous. There was all this talk about the informational campaigns in the countries that were part of the War on Terror, aka the countries we invaded. But within the West itself, did the Taliban ever do, you know, propaganda that hit the British people? No. There was not a piece of successful counter-propaganda from Afghanistan. There wasn't a piece of successful counter-propaganda from Iraq. Not that we saw. It was we as the West were completely insulated from it by design, and yet we have this portrayal of an asymmetrical information warfare that these structures are losing. And yet the domestic populations were never touched by the supposed adversary.
But the thing is, though, let's be honest, because that's not for us.
No.
And that would happen in environments where we don't exist. But it goes to show the fact that they're clearly thinking about this in terms of specific targets, specific demographics.
Yeah.
There is no general strategy for this. There is always the targeting of one group at the expense of another. I'll go up to the bit you've got there at the top.
Yes, sir. I was just trying to remember what this linked to. In the virtual dimension, the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, participants and non-participants, observed and observer becomes blurred. In the Daily Telegraph's opinion column editorial, Andrew Moore hinted at what this would mean for the future of wars. If ordinary troops can film anything and store it in tiny chips or send it straight on, then the gap between what actually happens in war and what the domestic audience knows about has been closed. On the one hand, one might say that Moore is falling into the journalist's conceited trap, which says that which is reported is true. The reporting by traditional media of the real battlefield is only part of the virtual dimension, but Maher does have his finger on something important. Still and moving imagery from the battlefield in such volumes, timeliness and form, and from a non-journalist perspective, is a new thing which is making a big difference in the conduct of modern insurgency. But the way in which that difference is made useful is by harnessing that live feed to potential to a political purpose by the addition of its to it of judgment, evaluation, subjectivity, selection bias, spin, and so on. The power of the image converted into propaganda is awesome. There's a bit more.
There's this page, bottom of page 23 in the conclusions.
I'm trying
the irony. We might as well, because we do want to do this page. I believe this is the one you picked out.
Where is it? I just want to talk about the fact that this really is him talking about London, New York, the work for advertising. Yeah, sorry. The irony not lost on the other side is that when it comes to the cultural ideation output, the West is hugely dominant. After all, the world's best propagandists live and work in places like London and New York. But they work in advertising, and their war concerns convincing people of such things as their lines would be more perfect if they could only shave with a razor with three blades instead of merely two. We'll do some more framing. We've been reading a lot here. We do brand marketing very well, and our politics have become an involved process of political marketing. In both cases, Western societies devote huge financial and manpower resources to the minute shifting of perceptions of consumers and voters on things such as what is fashionable and for whom they should vote. Well, David Betts doesn't seem to actually believe in democracy, does he?
To the ideologues of the Islamic world, the West represents a nigh irresistible and insensate force of cultural contamination and ideational infiltration. This is why they fear Britney Spears and Barbie more than they fear Joint Direct Action munitions and Tomahawk cruise missiles. In other words, at the eschatological narrative level, what animates Islamists is the gnawing concern of that globalization and democratization, which they perceive as little different from westernization, are enormously powerful and need resisting by the most extreme means.
Mr. Betts.
Yet, when it comes to the purposeful waging of societal ideational campaigns through propaganda, the West is laggard because it mistrusts and misunderstands the concept and does not apply it well in the virtual dimension. We have not figured out how to apply marketing muscle to warfare in quite the same way we do in other spheres of human endeavour. Indeed, our efforts in this sphere have mostly come to naught, where they have not been tried at all. On the other hand, Al-Qaeda has had a great success.
Yes.
Do you want the bottom of page 23 and then the conclusion then?
Yes, I'm trying to... what it was. Yes. This brings us on to part four. Fight the war of ideas like a real war, question mark.
A few
scholars and analysts are beginning to treat the war of ideas for what it really is. The centerpiece of the confrontation, which is properly called the Global War on Terror, or the Long War. They stopped calling it the Long War, by the way, because we all started calling it the Forever Wars, which is what this really is. Again, I will remind you that this full-throated analysis about full-spectrum information warfare is about pursuing the war on terror. It is about pursuing the democratization agenda. It is about pursuing the endless wars for the expansion of certain countries. But as it now officially termed, and to propose more appropriate strategies and operations. One of the most interesting of these is J. Michael Waller, who in his book, Fighting the War of Ideas Like a Real War, argues... argues, however, that the West should practice a form of semantic infiltration of Islamist discourse. Writes Waller, how great it would be if we could use Arabic words and Muslim terms to denounce the terrorists as sociopaths instead of holy warriors, as waging an unholy war on innocent society instead of fighting the good fight for God, as murderers instead of martyrs, as plagues that must be wiped out, and preferably by their own people. The good news is we can. Best of all, Muslims, all speakers of Arabic across the ideological spectrum, traditionally accept this terminology as we would like to mean, for we just need to embrace and promote the words in our own discourse and messages. For example, instead of using the laudatory Islamic term jihad to describe the actions of our enemies, we should use the derogatory Islamic term hiraba, which has the meaning of killing a defenseless victim by stealth in a manner intended to cause terror. In this, he is only partially correct and wrong in ways which risk further setbacks in the strategic conflict, which counts most.
I think the whatever conclusion, and it's not really going to be a conclusion, it's going to be the further arbitration of the grooming gang stuff in Britain, will have an angle of this to it. And really, in a certain respect, the British government is best placed taking the grooming gangs and turning that into an intra-Muslim problem, not a fundamental problem with our civilization. I think we just want the conclusions a bit now. I'll read through those if you want.
Yes, we do. We just want the conclusion and then we're going to add some more to this, but I think this is quite self-evident with what it's saying here. Conclusions. Insurgency and counterinsurgency in the global village.
In their 2006 book, Failing to Win, Tierney and Johnson argue persuasively that perceptions of victory and defeat matter. The virtual dimension which this article discusses may be intangible, but that does not diminish its importance. In ancient wars of conquest, clarity of result was more common, but undeniable triumph is the exception in most of the crises and wars of today. In these more ambiguous circumstances, observers searching for an evaluation, pushed by elite manipulation, pulled by the media, fall back on cognitive shortcuts and gut feelings, make their way through the complex information available to them. On their highly subjective and often skewed judgments rest the destiny of leaders, their states, and their peoples. The findings of this article support this contention and carry the discussion of the relationship of words and deeds and wartime into a consideration of the now emerging social media, which changes the rules of the media military government game in significant ways.
But let us pause here. The continuation, words and deeds in wartime. What David Betts is doing here and what a lot of the machinery does is to bring us into this frame in which we are at war. That is what the Forever Wars are about.
Putting you in a war state of mind.
But they are about being at war. And because we are at war, we must wield and fight an unlimited information war. Because why would you limit your information war? You're at war. This is the essence of what the Forever Wars are. They are a self-perpetuating machine of consent manufacture. They provide their own political energy. They are, at least in the metaphysical realm, meant as political perpetual motion machines. You need to have an unlimited information war because of the war on terror. But you need to pursue the war on terror to have your unlimited information war.
Key to understanding the new operating environment is accepting a redefinition of an old concept, propaganda of the deed. Traditionally, an aspect of the study of terrorism, propaganda of the deed is widely thought of as exclusively the province of terrorism. Indeed, the two are sometimes used synonymously. But this is wrong, because nowadays, both sides in the war of ideas conduct propaganda by deed in a radically globally interconnected information environment. The trouble is that one side recognises and embraces this fact, while the other basically does not, with predictable results. There is no doubt that this means the landscape of insurgency, which was never very simple in the first place, is shaping up to be an order of magnitude more complex in the 21st century. Of complicating factors, the most significant are globalization, which has been defined as an inexorable integration of markets,
nation states,
and technologies to a degree never witnessed before, in a way that is enabling individuals, corporations, and nation states to reach around the world farther, faster, deeper, and cheaper than ever before, in a way that is enabling the world to reach into individuals, corporations, and nation states farther, faster, deeper, and cheaper than ever before. And the emergence of a global insurgent movement, which is animated by religious ideology and which purports to represent the true will of a community of faith, which is transnational.
Well, this could mean anybody. Any group.
Some group of people opposed to possibly democratization?
Well, yeah, this is the framing of anybody opposed to globalization as an insurgent that must be dealt with in an unlimited capacity.
The United States and its allies are not facing a religion, Islam, as their main enemy, but an ideology, namely the Salafi Jihad. The fact that the Salafi Jihad is no ordinary secular ideology, but a religious one, however, is of additional significance, because it renders the attempt to challenge that ideology far more complex. Salafi jihadists employ religious rhetoric and symbols to advance their cause, although they selectively pick from the Islamic tradition only those elements that advance their narrow agenda. They nevertheless draw from the same religious sources that inform the lives and practices of more than a billion other Muslims. It's for that reason that ordinary Muslims, not to speak of non-Muslims, find it particularly difficult and dangerous to challenge Salafi jihadists without running the risk of being accused of targeting Islam as a whole. The upshot of the combinations of these factors is to make the potential audience global, whilst also fracturing it into segments. The effect of deeds, propagandic acts, or words is not homogenous. On the contrary, the same deed sends out different messages and resonates in different ways simultaneously to potentially multiple audiences.
This is very important.
For instance, the previous noted failed suicide bombing in Afghanistan was meant operationally to cause shock in the local and international media, and thereby draw attention to the cause. Tactically, to engage the counterinsurgent forces and provoke retaliation. Communicatively, to attach itself to underlying grievances, both local and transnational. And strategically, at the top level, to expand the Islamist constituency by showing boldness in attack and also enticing threatening governments to meet violence with violence, thereby further delegitimizing their authority. Thus, we may say that target audiences were respectively the local political economy, hierarchical politics, that is, the sovereignty of the Afghan state, at top level, ethnic and tribal identity politics, and ideological politics in the scale of a global ummah.
Both the insurgent and counterinsurgent propagandists, therefore, are presented with a thorny problem of market segmentation and targeting. Ironically, Islamist insurgents, more than any other actor in the international scene so far, have mastered the arts of marketing for warlike purpose. By contrast, state-based counterinsurgents have not managed this shift nearly as well. There's a bit I'm going to get to. As this paper has argued, we are lagging in the virtual dimension for four main reasons. First, we do not take it seriously enough, and therefore the tools we try to fight with are not fit for purpose. Second, to the extent we do engage in the virtual dimension, we concentrate too much on shifting Muslim opinion on the aspect of their religious faith that we as outsiders cannot effectively voice opinion on. This is not to say we have not a stake in the outcomes of the debate, we obviously do, but the surest way to make it go against us is to get involved in it. Third, we pay almost no attention to the audience to which we have access and understand our own population. He said this three times throughout this, you will notice. This is his third invocation of the use of military intelligence on the domestic population as a whole, which includes Muslims in the West, whose allegiance to global jihad is what Islamists crave more than anything. Fourth, our efforts at narrative construction falter because they lack vertical coherence. In his far-seeing classic, Understanding Media, Marshall McLuhan wrote, as electricity contracted, the globe is no more than a village. Whether or not this was true when he wrote it in 1964, it is very much true now. It is far too soon for any social scientist or historian to tackle seriously the question of the impact of the internet on human society. We can say with confidence, however, that the impact is very large and that it is manifest in particularly every aspect of human enterprise, including warfare. Global insurgents have grasped how to conduct warfare in the global village. Global counterinsurgents should take the lesson.
So, to consider, it's all about narrative. It's all about truthiness. It's all about that top-line story and having an existential problem that you must solve.
And you're most...
So,
yes.
When your war in the Middle East or your wars in the Middle East aren't going your way, why not convince everyone else on your side that what you're fighting isn't just a couple of farmers in a field...
Yes.
It's a global insurgency that exists online as an intangible, but it really matters.
Also, if you are fighting an insurgency, you must support insurgents against those insurgents. Mm. The enemy of your enemy is your friend. And so, to bring out the value free dimension, we've read all of this. We've read all of this, but this is strategic communications in practice. What is David Betts writing in aid of? David Betts is writing in aid of the global war on terror. What is the result of the global war on terror? Well, the US interventions in arming the good rebels in Syria are what caused the 2014 refugee crisis. Those actions were part of the very operations Betts was advocating an unlimited informational warfare to keep going. This is what David Betts' unlimited informational war is for. This is what it's in aid of. It is in aid of arming the good Syrian rebels so refugees pour into Europe. The forever war and our participation in it is the key justification for bringing these people here. If you look at all pro-immigration propaganda when it comes to Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, the main thrust of it is the forever wars. It is, we bombed these people, therefore we need to bring them here. This is David Betts' informational warfare. The informational warfare to keep the forever wars going is also the informational warfare to bring these people here. You can't have one without the other. They are two sides of the same operation. They do double duty. The same is true with Afghanistan, with information warriors going as far as to impose a super injunction, preventing the British public
reporting
on the Afghan migrants have been brought here en masse.
Thank you, Robert Jenrick.
Yes, thank you, Robert Jenrick. The Afghan super injunction is the information management in regards to domestic populations in practice. This is David Betts' information war. This is the unrestricted use of information warfare against the domestic population. This is exactly what David Betts was advocating for in information dominance of the domestic realm, of the audience we have most access to, our own. This is what it looks like. This is counterinsurgency in practice. You're going to have unrest in Britain if you bring tens of thousands of Afghan warlords and their families here. Just make the courts hide it for years. For years, they sat and lied to us with super injunctions on this for years. But this is what an information war looks like in practice. Again, here, yeah, Right Honourable Robert Jenrick MP, welcoming Afghan refugees is a national project. The operation was primed by our own officials, presenting a narrative that we owe these people, these migrants, a place in Britain because of their role in the Afghan War, a war explicitly endorsed by David Betts as late as 2017 in his work with NATO. Again, this is what David Betts' narratives are in aid of. It's about it's about perpetual war and perpetual refugee farms. A perpetual war in Syria is also a perpetual refugee farm. Iraq, refugee farm. Afghanistan, refugee farm. Libya, refugee farm. Sudan, refugee farm. All of this is the other side of his operation. And like I said, going to bat for the war on terror in 2008 is disgusting. But going to bat for it in 2017...
You're on page 62.
I know I am, yes.
What do you want me to start from here?
Is unconscionable. Well, I'm going to go back to the top here because I just want to show you which paper this is. This is putting the strategy back into strategic communications, David Betts and Vaughan Phillips, and this is the NATO one we were talking about. This is from the official journal of NATO Strategic Communications. For their center of excellence, apparently. But,
right. Strategic communications in the West, at any rate, too often convince themselves that they are subtler and a more powerful tool than in fact they are or ever could be. It is no surprise that war by other means, a mantra held dearly by those who believed so earnestly in the power of information systems to produce cheap and practical bloodless victories a generation ago.
That was you!
Well, no, it wasn't, because he did recognise the fact that the tip of the spear was still the tip of the fucking spear. Yeah. A belief, it is a fallacy. Strategic communications is, at its best, a red flag to a bull. A mystifying device behind which there is the sharp point of a sword towards which one's own enemy's momentum propels him. Without the sword, there is just a matador dressed in two tight sequin trousers about to be trampled and perforated by an angry animal many times his size. Fantastic admission there. Informational focused aspect of counterinsurgency was so effective that Western forces relied on it totally to try and therapeutize all these conflicts out of existing. And in this one instance, Betts actually has to turn around and go, sorry, this conflict's still going on.
Well,
it's still, I know we've talked about it in such unreality, in such terms of unreality for years, but it's actually still going on.
You have to put the bull to the sword. What he's saying here is that the information war doesn't make sense without an actual war, without the sword. And I wanted to include this because what he's saying here, if you are being therapeutized, it's not a counterinsurgency of words. The 77th Brigade being used against the British population is so alarming, not because of the propaganda, but it's because it's a sign that they are going to use the sword. I read this again. Strategic communications are at best a red flag to a bull, a mystifying device behind which there is a sharp point of a sword towards which one's own enemy's momentum propels him.
As if one were to get one's enemy to step on a rake forever.
Forever. But he's talking about you, stupid. He's talking about you anyway.
Strategic communications is an intrinsic element of war. It is not a device for achieving things on its own, or cheaply, quietly, or agreeably, which we cannot or will not contemplate achieving by other means of forcing compliance. It is an adjunct of force, otherwise supportive, contributive, potentially supernumerary, not a thing by itself. It is something of a cliché now to quote Clausewitz's injunction that the supreme act, far and most far-reaching act of the statesman and commander, is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking, neither mistaking it for nor trying to turn into something that is alien to its nature. Nonetheless, it's true. Attempting to deconstruct complex narratives alien to its own, the West's counter-narrative approach fails to match its adversary's agility, credibility, and propensity to take risk. The narrative of its foes succeed, not because they displace or counter the West narrative, but because they capitalise on the master narratives of the population they care about. It is this population to which their communicators are intimately tied by individual and collective identity, whose perspectives they innately understand, and to whom they can precisely articulate the enemy, picture of their enemy's defeat, and how that defeat should be accomplished. Countering violent extremism in strategic communications terms, on the other hand, has become a substitute for real political military strategy and action at a point where the time for words substituting for deeds has passed. It has already been 7 years since a senior American commander remarked that we have allowed strategic communication to become a thing instead of a process. An abstract thought instead of a way of thinking is now sadly something of a cottage industry.
This is David Betts turning round to the American military and the British military establishment and going, you do realise the internet isn't real, right? This should be the ultimate, like, bonfire of the poosters. If you're some Twitter pooster, if you're somebody who's talking about how many likes and views and Twitter bucks they get, these people are laughing at you. You are a matador not holding a sword. You can't conduct an information war against an enemy who is holding a sword. David Betts is telling you this in extremely plain terms, but he's also telling you if there is an information war being waged against you, and in fact, if you are waging an information war which creates a retaliatory information war from the state, they aren't waging an information war, they're waging a real war. What David Betts is saying here is that the real civil war is between the British state and the British people, in a real sense, and that he is on the side of the British state, because he understands that the British state is the side holding the sword.
Mm.
That's what he's really saying. And David Betts is participating in this war in a communications manner, but he's also encouraging those whose communications he helps create consent for that they need to use their sword, that he cannot be left out here naked. And really, this is an admission that you still have to bomb them, stupid. It's an admission that strategic communications are about shutting people up as you vaporize them. And if strategic communications are being used on the British population, it's because those using them want us to shut up while we're being dispatched.
Right.
I don't think there's much else to add here.
No, I think I might suggest...
I would say also that I want you to think about this in the context of the summer riots in 2024.
Yes.
It offends a lot of people, but the Patriots did not rise up. The summer riots didn't happen. This is a bin fire. This is not a civil war. And I'll put this up again. There is no movement. There is no insurgency. There is no information war to be countered. Do not become an information warrior without a sword. You look like an idiot.
Absolutely. I tell you what there is, though, if you're interested. I believe Wefflings, the people who publish our good book, just gone live on Millennial, for those that are interested in watching that.
Okay.
Please do pop over and support our friend Mr. Consumer, because he has done a lot of work with the Wefflings stuff this year. And not only just with our book, has done a very good job of it. And I might even suggest look out for some more interesting releases later on into next year, possibly.
Possibly. Well, we'll see.
But anyway. Otherwise, we will see you possibly after the New Year's, I would imagine.
Probably, yes.
Right. Have a good, very good Christmas and go to the pub, you lot. Good night.
Good night.